What I should like to do, essentially this morning, is to make a few comments on a text. The text was released by Mrs. Golda Meir, the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, some 2 weeks ago. It represents the Israeli response to the convening of conversations among the big four powers designed to develop some kind of formula for solution to the problems of the Middle East. Israel, she said, is not, will not become the object of power politics or intra-power politics, and will not accept any recommendation which is in conflict with her vital interests, her rights, and her security. She added that though it was difficult for her to believe that the four disparate major powers of our globe could arrive at any consensus, any agreement, even if they did, and when they did, Israel would not accept it. Now, as you know, Thursday last, Mr. Charles Yost, on behalf of the United States, Mr. Yaakov Malik, on behalf of the Soviet Union, Mr. Armand Berard, on behalf of France, and Lord Carradine, on behalf of Great Britain, respective ambassadors of their states to the United Nations, met in the home of the French ambassador on Park Avenue and began the first procedural meetings of this Big Four conference. It was in a real way symbolic to have this first meeting in the French ambassador's home, where the convening of such a meeting has been one of the stated objectives of General de Gaulle's policy for well over 2 years now. His argument has been deceptively simple and seemingly conclusive, where he has put it out that it is obvious that the various states in the Middle East have been unable to resolve their various problems over the last 21 years, that in fact the situation has become exacerbated, has deteriorated, and it threatens again major war, unless the major powers of the globe, the powers which have leverage, which can twist arms and beat some heads together, enter the arena, this whole powder keg is liable to explode in the face of the world powers. Soviet Union, for most of the time since the June War of 1967, has, as you know, agreed with the French initiative. And if you'd understand the Israeli reaction, the first thing that you must understand is that they are well cognizant and aware, fully aware, of where the initiative for this conference lay. And it did not come from their friends. France, as you'll recall, in May of 1967, placed an embargo on any further delivery of supersonic jet fighters to Israel, and impounded the funds of the Israeli government, which had already been forwarded to France against the delivery of those planes. Subsequent to the June war, France prohibited the shipment to Israel of some millions of dollars worth of spare parts for her armored carriers and her planes, which had long since been ordered, and shipped to Lebanon, to Syria, and to Iraq, as well as to Jordan, armored carriers, howitzers, missiles, and supersonic planes, all of which, of course, are offensive weapons, which have only one possible target, target being, of course, the State of Israel. France has at the United Nations accepted the, and championed indeed, the Arab position, She has refused to go along with any condemnation of activity in the Middle East, which mentioned both the provocation, the terrorism, and the Israeli retaliation. And just 10 days ago, the French vetoed an associate membership for Israel in the European Economic Community, at the same time championing and gaining entrance into that community for similar membership for two of the Arab states. France can hardly sit down at a Big Four conference table as an impartial observer. Israel can hardly believe that France has her own, has Israel's proper security interests at heart, and she can well wonder indeed what Israeli interests she does have at heart. All of this has been very profitable to France. In the last 2 years, French exports to the Levant have increased fivefold. And Arab gold, born of Arab oil, has been one of the weapons with which Mr. de Gaulle has been able to attack the pound sterling and the dollar in the world financial crisis and market. The position of the Soviet Union at this point in time needs hardly to be underscored. The Soviet Union has been the active champion of the Arabs for the last 15 years. Indeed, I am convinced that the case can be made and substantiated that were it not for the activities of the Soviet Union, were it not for the now almost $7 billion worth of sophisticated weapons which the Soviet Union has brought into the Middle East, all on one side, were it not for the propaganda of the Soviet Union against the State of Israel, were it not for the training by Soviet technicians of Arab forces, were it not for the quite open championing of the Arab position at the United Nations, the giving to the Arab nations in effect of a carte blanche, any resolution which is brought into the United Nations which has a chance of passing, which mentions and condemns Arab terrorism, will receive the Russian veto. Were it not for all of these activities of the Soviet Union, the Middle East would not have been bathed in war in 1956, would not have been bathed in war again in 1967, and would not again be in a crisis situation in 1969. The Soviet Union has been far more than the agent provocateur, and she has been that. You recall the scurrying around of the Arab Russian ambassador to Jerusalem in the late days of May in 1967, when he broadcast to the world all kinds of false statements of Israeli troop mobilization along the northern borders, one of the precipitant emotional causes of that war. Zionism is in the Soviet Union a heresy against the political orthodoxy of the day. Israel is condemned in terms which might better be reserved for Nazi Germany. And all in all, the Soviet position is one of an agent of aggression against the State of Israel. It would seem that common decency would recognize that any Big Four conference is one in which the cards are stacked against Israel. But there's a feeling about in some quarters that the situation is not quite as unbalanced and as unjust and patently unfair as it seems on the surface. For as the papers sometimes say to us, if the Big Four sit down and there are two who champion the Arab cause, there are also two who champion the Israeli cause. But let's look at the facts. The third party in a big power conference is, of course, Great Britain. Great Britain, as you know, has no great love of Israel. Great Britain has a long history of involvement in and sympathy for the Arab states. Mr. Michael Stewart, the British Foreign Minister, said in Parliament during a discussion of this issue just a few days ago, that there's an urgent need, he said, for some degree of urgent persuasion upon the powers in the Middle East which will bring about stability. And why does England need stability? Because British interests in the Middle East are to maintain and, if possible, to increase their share of a fast-growing market and to ensure the flow of oil. There are handsome dividends to be gained. England's only interest in the Middle East is commercial and mercantile. She wants the canal opened. She wants to bring the oil from Persia more quickly to the markets of Europe. She wants to be readmitted to the bazaars of Baghdad and Damascus and Cairo. She wants back some of the preferential trade agreements which she enjoyed before 1956 and even before 1967, and she wants them now. And this is not the kind of interest which takes as one of its major preconditions the security or the security needs of a small Israeli state in the Middle East. England will in all probability go along with the United States, but England can hardly be classified as a friend of Israel. So when the Big Four sit down in New York to discuss the Middle East, there are two powers there who champion the Arab cause, one who champions only her own economic interests, and then there is the United States. The United States is a special case in point. Does the fact that one of the superpowers have interest in and traditional friendship for the State of Israel, in fact, balance the scales at these meetings? The Israelis believe no, and they have good reason for that belief. They argue that there is a great difference between the active championing of the Arab cause and America's even-handed and balanced friendship for Israel. And they make these points. When the United States wishes to circulate a position paper about the Middle East, she calls in Abba Iban, she calls in King Hussein, and she calls in other Arab heads of states and other Arab ambassadors and discusses it all openly with them. When the Soviet Union wants to make a pronouncement on the Middle East, there is no diplomatic relationship now between Israel and the Soviet Union. She calls in her Arab clients and does what is agreed between them. When there is a vote at the United Nations, the Russian position, the French position, is wholehearted support of all the lies and all the unbalanced calumny which the Arab states are putting forth at that moment. The American position is judicious. The American position is more balanced. But the American position is not sufficiently strong to prevent the writing of a false record of guilt and responsibility for the activities in the Middle East. And the events of this last week in New York are a case in point. For the last 6 weeks, there has been constant howitzer shelling of the Jewish settlements in the Baisan Valley by Jordanian cannon. In the past 6 weeks, there have been almost 50 incursions by El Fateh saboteurs and terrorists from Jordanian territory into Israel. 10 days ago, the Israelis made a sortie, a retaliatory sortie, against an El Fateh base near Salt in Jordan. Jordan made a protested this to the United Nations. The Russians were eager to not only to condemn Israel, but to invoke, if possible, military sanctions against Israel. The United States was able to water down the condemnation resolution, so it did not contain any reference to the various United Nations charter provisions which might refer to military sanction. But when it came to the vote, there were 11 votes for and 4 abstentions. The United States would not cast its veto. The United States would not prevent the writing into the record of the United Nations a condemnation of Israel for this retaliatory action, which made no reference to the provocation and to the cause. A resolution which our own ambassador, Mr. Yost, characterized, and I quote, as unbalanced, unrealistic, and unlikely to move the parties towards a peaceful solution. American balance versus Russian championship does not make for a fair meeting of the superpowers. The one is wholeheartedly committed, The one has many irons in the fire. Israel cannot bank on American friendship to stand up fully against Russian partisanship. Israel is not and will not become the object of power politics, of intra-power politics, and will not accept any recommendation which is in conflict with her vital interests, her rights, and her security. That is Mrs. Meir's pronouncement in our text. And as if to prove the appropriateness of Israel's response, once it had been decided to move from the bilateral conversations in London and Paris and Moscow and Washington to this actual big power meeting, the United States began to circulate among the big powers and among the nations of the Middle East a position paper. It was a rather interesting document. Apparently, this paper began with a statement which the Israelis can accept. And that is that there must be no demand for withdrawal, there must be no change in the present position until the whole package of arrangements between Israel and the Arab states have been signed and accredited. But then it went on to lay down what it believed to be a fair and equitable final solution. It involved the return of the Golan Heights to Syria, the West Bank, to Jordan, of Sinai to Israel, to Egypt. Gaza would become part of Jordan with some kind of a strip to be controlled by the Jordanians running from Gaza to the West Bank. Jerusalem would become a unified city with some kind of Jordanian involvement in its government. There would be some kind of agreement on Israel's borders. There would be a demilitarized zone between the Israel's borders and those of the Arab states. There would be a United Nations or Big Four presence to guarantee these borders, and there would be a free passage of Israeli ships through the Gulf of Tehran and the Suez Canal. And finally, there would be some kind of admittance of the existence and the sovereignty of the several states in the area. Now, what troubled Israel about this document was that it existed in the first place. Here was a document purporting to be a possible final solution offered at the very beginning of a bargaining negotiation, which at the very most is at the bottom range of those agreements to which Israel might possibly become a signatory. In other words, the United States seemed to have already bargained away almost every advantage that Israel has to put upon the negotiating table before the meeting has ever even been opened. Before the Soviet Union has stated its position, before France has stated its position, before the Big Four have arrived at some kind of consensus, before the Arabs have gotten their teeth into the document. At the very beginning, Israel's minimal position is stated. Mr. Abba Ibn was moved to say, "The most serious deterioration in the American position is that a paper which does not meet many of Israel's demands should be regarded as a basis for negotiation with the three other powers." If this is the basis for negotiation, how much more will we be asked to give up before these negotiations are completed? Israel feels that between Arab champions, this kind of American friendship, which is working always to take a balanced, middle, understandable position, she can only lose. If she had a champion, and the Arabs had a champion, then we might have there might be some bargaining which would be meaningful. But in this case, the American position is given a pitchon peh, an opening for all kinds of further accommodations, and Israel can hardly accept the basic document itself. And Israel wonders, moreover, who will guarantee such an arrangement? Assume that the Big Four can impose upon the Arab states sufficiently so that even they may sign, the heads of states may sign such a document. Who can enforce it? Will the Soviet Union enforce a document if the Arab states determine a year from now or 6 months from now to violate its terms? It's become very popular among ideologues and all kinds of people in our world to believe that any any means is justified to achieve one's end. We live in a strange world in which one's word counts for very little, in which people talk about the sacredness of violence, in which people talk very happily about using all kinds of subterfuges in order to achieve their end. The Arab world has never gone back on its statement that its ultimate purpose is the eradication of the State of Israel. It could very easily create a self-justification for violating any or all of these terms. And if she does, if she orders the United Nations troop off of the demilitarized zone, if she occupies parts of the zone, if she denies Israeli shipping through the canal or through the gates of Tehran, who will enforce these rights on behalf of Israel? The Soviet Union? Hardly. France? Hardly. Great Britain? Hardly. What about the United States? Well, Israel has a long memory. And Israel remembers that in February of 1957, Secretary Dulles on behalf of the United States and Mr. Abba Iban on behalf of the State of Israel signed an aid memoir in Washington just before the Israeli pulled back from the last advance into Sinai, which dealt with two items. The first was a UN command, the United Nations command in the Gaza Strip. It was not to be returned to Egypt. And secondly, the right of free passage of Israeli ships and of all ships in and out of the Straits of Tehran. In March of 1957, just 1 month later, an Egyptian military command showed up in Gaza. Mrs. Golda Meir, as the foreign minister of Israel, protested to Secretary Dulles and never received a responsive answer. 10 years later, Mr. Nasser suddenly closed Sharm el-Sheikh. Israeli ships could no longer move in and out of Eilat. Israel made protestation to Washington. And Washington, as you remember, conceived 1,000 schemes that would somehow bring international pressure to open the Straits of Tehran, but in fact, no such scheme was ever set on foot. Who will enforce such a document? Can Israel trust the Big Four or any one of them? And if she cannot trust the Big Four, can she trust the United Nations? Hardly. The Security Council is a council on which the Soviet Union has a veto. 6 of the 15 members of the Soviet Council of the Security Council have no diplomatic relationships now with the State of Israel. In 19 years, there has never been a pro-Israel resolution passed by the Security Council. Never once, unilaterally, have any Arab states been slapped on the wrist for any action taken against Israel. Israel is not and will not become the object of power politics, intra-power politics, and will not accept any recommendation which is in conflict with her vital interests, her rights, and her security. Israel knows where Russian interests lie. Israel knows where the French interests lie and where the English interests lie. So let's talk for a moment about our own American interests. Israel is very much concerned, and one can understand it, that in America's urgency to find in the Soviet Union a lever which will move North Vietnam towards peace, she may bargain away some of Israel's position. It's cheap enough for a big power to offer what only a little power has to lose. And the United States today desperately needs friends, or at least allies, any place in the world who can move us towards an end of this terrible imbroglio in Vietnam. And Israel is very much conscious of the fact that the United States would be willing to pay a very high price for aid in ending that war. Israel is also very conscious of the fact that the State Department is very much concerned about the loss of American economic prestige and economic advantage in the oil fields, in the sulfur mines, and in the markets of the Middle East. There are great commercial interests in the United States, mercantile interests, manufacturing interests, and banking interests, which have great investments in that part of the world and which look upon the Arab dislike of the United States' friendship for Israel as an impediment to their making of even larger profits. Israel is very conscious of the fact that the United States is eager to develop a rapprochement with General de Gaulle in order to avoid this kind of loggerhead which has developed in the financial marketplaces of the world, as Mr. de Gaulle pits the franc against the dollar, and that we may be willing to pay quite a price in order to achieve better relations with the Soviet Union. Vietnam, an East-West detente, non-proliferation treaty, all of these, and the need to shore up our relationships with France, make Israel leery of becoming the object of power politics or intra-power politics. What are Israel's concerns? Israel's concerns are with her own security. And she knows that for all of the dangers implicit in the million Arabs who are now within her borders, with all of the violence implicit in the attack of the Al-Fateh and the other terrorists, with all of the dangers implicit in occasional bombings of the Baisan Valley and across the Suez Canal, with all of that, she is more secure with these larger borders than she would be if she were had to return to the borders of 1967 or 1956 or 1948. And that, in fact, these present borders guarantee her to a certain degree against an immediate attack. And she needs to have that kind of military guarantee supplanted by strong political guarantees before she can see her way towards any negotiated settlement. And so we are moving in our world towards a time where we may very well see the United States government very angry with the state of Israel for being so obstinate and so obdurate, for taking a position which conflicts with America's national self-interest, and which is very much in line with Israel's self-interest. America may very well feel at some time that a just agreement has been arranged by the Big Four. And she may be very impatient with what she'll call Israel's niggling or pettifogging response. When Israel begins to ask, who will guarantee the treaty? How do we know that these terms will be abided? We need to have the signature of the Arabs, not just their assent. Who will guarantee that our sovereignty is accredited? We may very well see a time when the United States is moved towards a position of bringing some kinds of sanctions against the state of Israel in order to bring Israel to her knees. Israel is conscious of that fact. Just a few days ago, Mr. Abba Eban said, we went against the pressure of the world for 4 months in 1957. We can, if necessary, go against the pressures of the world for 4 years in 1969. But pray God this situation may never come. Pray God that the present administration in Washington means what it says, that Israel will not be placed in the bind of American power. America will not lean upon Israel until a total package has been agreed upon by all the nations, a workable package, a package which can, in fact, be enforced. If that be the case, and if America does not move away from its present hard position, requiring a complete arrangement of the Middle East, a complete rearrangement of its political crises, before Israel is asked to withdraw one way or another, lose its bargaining power, then perhaps something may come of these conversations, and then at least the tensions between the United States and Israel will not become more dangerous. The next few months, I'm afraid, are going to be a time which are going to try the soul of American Jews and men of goodwill generally. Israel is a small state. Israel is the Ethiopia of the 1960s. Israel is the Czechoslovakia of the 1960s. The world is again going to fight out to see whether it has a conscience or no. Whether everything is simply naked power politics, or whether the rights of a small people, of a free people, of a people which has pioneered on a land and created a green land, in a prosperous nation, whether these rights will indeed in some way be preserved and protected. Or whether in fact these rights will be bargained away because the big powers have greed in their eyes, or other irons in the fire, or because they are preoccupied in other parts of the world. For Israel, we can only pray for strength, the strength of its convictions. For ourselves, we can only pray for strength, a recognition of the legitimacy of Israel's position, and an unwillingness to adapt that fawning and sycophantic attitude which characterized so many American Jews in times past. Whenever Jewish interests around the world conflicted with the immediate preoccupation of this nation, whenever Israel was talked about before there was an Israel and men began to question why trouble the waters, there were always those Jews who said, we oughtn't to do it. What will the non-Jews say? How will our government react? I hope, I trust that kind of fear has long since been dissipated from our Jewish systems. I pray that we recognize that so much of what we are and so much of what we have depends upon the security of Israel, not only in terms of the Jewish people, but in terms of our own dignity and self-respect. If the time comes when Israel must take a position which runs counter to that which the United States says is its position at the moment, and perhaps we will have to work towards changing the position of our own government. But none of us ought to still be laboring under the misapprehension that he lives in the 1920s rather than the 1960s. That we still live in an era where we can talk happily of brotherhood and of men of goodwill and of a growing feeling of relationship and friendship among all the groups and peoples of the world. In the old Jewish liturgy, I close with this, there was in the daily service among the various petitional prayers of the Amidah, one which began, V'lamalshinim al tehi tikva. For those who defame and detract Israel, let there be no hope. In the 1880s and the 1890s, in the heyday of liberalism, when men believed that a great brand new world was just around the corner, the reformers took this petition out of the service. They held it to be undignified. They held it to be untrue. They admitted that anger and fear and frustration are among the most natural of human reactions. But they said Israel has long since emerged from the ghetto. She is no longer surrounded by the jackals who seek her blood. She no longer need fear those who would destroy her. And then came Hitler, and then came the Arab world, and Israel has had to learn again the hard truth that not all people like us, that not all people are reasonable, that many are prejudiced and hate and would willingly kill us and erase us from the face of the world. Mr. Nasser in many ways reminds me of the world's reactions to Mr. Nasser remind me in many ways of the early reactions of our world to Mr. Hitler. Nobody believed Mein Kampf. But Adolf Hitler meant exactly what he had written there. And Mr. Nasser has throughout the years never changed his tune. We will not recognize Israel. We will not conduct negotiations with Israel. We will not make peace with Israel. We will eradicate the state of Israel. And Mr. Nasser is prepared to use any and all means and techniques in order to achieve it. The terrorists are not paramilitary groups operating out of caves unbeknownst to him. Listen to him speaking just 2 months ago to the El Fateh. I must stress the glorious action carried out by the Palestinian resistance forces. They fulfill a vital task in sapping the enemy's strength and spilling his blood. The United Arab Republic places all its resources at the disposal of these organizations without condition or reservation. Now, I am not advocating this morning that we return to our liturgy a prayer against those who are so calloused and so confirmed in their hate that they would destroy Israel, that they would destroy the Jewish people. But I am advocating that we recognize the kind of world that we live in. And it's not a very nice place. It's a world in which people hate, and hate desperately, and hate bitterly. It's a world in which people bend the truth to their own use, justify any and all means to whatever they believe to be the true end. A world is not without hope. The amount of hope and promise which we saw in it a generation ago simply isn't there. These are going to be desperate years and desperate times, not only for Israel, but for decency generally and for freedom, for justice. Our particular struggle, our particular thing, is the survival of this little state. And I pray that we will understand her objectives. She too wants peace. But she knows that they must come in direct negotiations with the Arab world. She knows that a Big Four meeting can only give the Arab states another piece of paper, other powers, other political ploys behind which to operate. She is very much afraid that these meetings have not increased the chance for peace, but in fact decreased it. She is prepared tomorrow to meet with any or all of the Arab states to discuss any or all of the outstanding issues between them. And that's the way of peace. And she is remembering what our fathers taught us years and years ago. Al tiftachu binadivim. Don't trust in the princes. Don't trust in the diplomats of the world. Each has his own fish to fry. They use the golden world's words to justify the particular greed of their nation. Man must ultimately trust in his own courage, his own conviction, and that is Israel's trusts, and pray God it may be vindicated. Amen.